Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. David Smith is arguably America's greatest sculptor of the 20th century. His art enlarged the vocabulary of sculpture by employing welding and industrial processes and materials, laying the groundwork for the directness of minimalism and the realization that sculpture could be anything the artist desired. Smith's oeuvre is a logical outgrowth of earlier 20th century sculptural trends in cubism, constructivism, and surrealism. However, his work also represents a new paradigm for the language of modern sculpture that reflects the dynamic growth and industrial prowess of the United States after the Second World War. Smith's confrontation with the process of creation broke the rules and expanded the possibilities of his art form. In part two of this lecture, presented at the National Gallery of Art on March 7, 2019, senior lecturer David Gariff explores Smith's revolutionary art through a discussion of some of his most important and innovative works, including the Agricola, Tank Totem, Sentinel, Zig, Voltri, and Cubi series.
Welcome to the National Gallery. My name is David Gariff. I'm a senior lecturer here, and I'm talking about the sculptures of David Smith. After the Tank Totems, the next great series is the Zig series, Z-I-G. And this is Zig number 6, although it's a question mark after that, I'll mention in a second. The Zig series contains some of the most abstract sculptures by David Smith. Zig comes from the term ziggurat, which are the old Mesopotamian forms of pyramids, but you can't take that too literally. What it really means for Smith is simply stacking things, sort of putting things on top of each other. It's not that he's trying to recreate a Mesopotamian form. What's beautiful about the Zig series, and this is especially true in the welding, you know, I mean, I get really excited about these, is they are much more emphatically built or constructed. When you look at the Zig series, you sense somebody constructing something. And he often uses now industrial I-beams as his materials. He uses industrial paints. He's fascinated with color that isn't the color that painters use. It's not the beautiful colors that you can get, but it's the colors that are industrial. The colors he refers to, he almost always talks about color as, I want raw color, R-A-W, raw color. So he's not interested in something being decorative in that sense. This is the big debate here about whether and how we look at Smith sculptures when they're painted. This is true with Anthony Caro, and others as well, but I'll save that for a few minutes down the road. This one particularly retains a type of figurative idea. It's kind of vertical, so you have that. But the other thing that he's introduced here now are wheels. It's on wheels here, right? And the wheels here, initially in the Zig series, are just to allow him to move this stuff around. he can't pick this up with his arm and carry it somewhere. So he's starting to put things on wheels, and the wheel is not really part of the sculpture. Here it's just a functional idea of allowing him to move these things. Later, wheels are going to become part of his language of sculpture, but at this point, they have a kind of functional idea. These are two great ones, both photographed at Bolton Landing. Zig 2 on the left from 1961, and Zig 8 on the right from 1964. Today, the Zig on the left is at Des Moines. It's in the Des Moines Art Center. And the one on the right is in Boston, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. You know, when people look at these sculptures, you have to think about it for a minute. It's one thing to look at a bronze or a marble or to look at a Rodin and you can see his fingers and all that kind of stuff. This is a different thing, but you have to be as acute in your vision and as patient to understand the forms and how he's put them together. Because now what he's doing is he's taking a huge, gigantic pipe, right? And he's cut it on the vertical. He hasn't cut it into rings. You see what I'm saying? He's cut it down the vertical. And now he has this huge form that is like almost a radar dish because it has both concavity and convexity. And depending on how he plays with that, and then how, in this case, how he paints it. Notice this paint is very expressive, abstract expression, very loose and painterly. This is very tight. And these are not sprayed. This is hand painted here, right? At night, I go home through the atrium to the exit in the East Building, and we currently have that Smith sculpture, black, white, forward, right near the information desk. And when you look at that forward, that painting, or that sculpture from the front, you see the black and white and all of that. But if you come around to the side and make sure you position yourself so that the plate, the big plate, is right sort of to your eye, the whole sculpture turns black. And all of the forms change. It's absolutely remarkable. So the Zig series has a lot of that, but it also has a lot of experimental cutting of pipe now along the vertical. And he certainly had not used color to this extent until we get to the Zig series. This is one of my favorites. This is just, it's fantastic. This is Zig 4 from 1961. Some of you may have seen this. Does anybody know where this is today? It's not in a museum. Well, I guess technically it is a museum, but it's not in a museum in the traditional sense. It's at Lincoln Center. They have an art collection at Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, and that's where the sculpture is. This might be the best one in the series. This relates to what I was just talking about upstairs, in the East Building, the black-white forward. Black-white forward is not a Zig, but boy, it could live with the Zigs with no problem. And it's the same here with a Zig. The way you manipulate and maneuver around this sculpture, where you think you're seeing something that must extend like a tubular form, and then you realize it's just like a cap. It's just the flat part. The idea of tilting up the plate to make it almost like a relief sculpture, but a relief sculpture that projects in all different ways. The fact that this whole big, huge thing is balanced on this little point, all of that is magnificent. So the Zigs, he uses color in the Zigs in different ways. This is multi, it's not just one uniform color. It's kind of this gold with some red and green. He'll either use color to emphasize or de-emphasize surfaces and forms. It'll either emphasize the fact that this is a particular shape, or it'll make you think it's not that shape, that it's something else. Then he'll use color often to unify various sections. I want to bring all these things together, so he'll do it that way. And sometimes that will also be used then to soften the effects. I don't want you to really think about this as hard metal. I want you to think about it as something softer. And then the third way, he'll use it as contrast between formal dichotomies. Solid void, progression, recession, spatial illusionism and flatness, that kind of idea. Here's the Zig at Lincoln Center. You can start to see the paint here. And here's the guy who's the curator of the collection at Lincoln Center. His name is Tom Lawlor, L-O-L-L-A-R. He's the director of the visual arts at the center. And so this is two other views here. Now, the other influence here in the Zig series, especially this one that I haven't mentioned yet, we mentioned surrealism, certainly important, classical traditions, all of that. But Smith went, when he was in Europe, he went to the Soviet Union. And the reason he went to the Soviet Union was, aside from politics, was to see constructivism. So the works of the Russian constructivists, L. Lizitsky, Vladimir Tatlin, all of these artists are very important. This kind of constructed, relief-like, collage-like effect that they're magnificent at in terms of design, especially. So that's another important influence. Now we get to the legend. If he isn't a legend by now, this is what caps off his legend. In 1962, he's invited by the Italian government to participate at the fourth Spoleto Festival in Spoleto. And they have invited 13 of the most important sculptors in the world to submit one work of art for an exhibition. The two most important, who probably were the two greatest sculptors, at least in terms of reputation, that were known at this time, were Henry Moore and Alexander Calder. So they were both asked to submit works. Smith was asked to submit work. At this point, he certainly did not have the reputation of Moore or Calder. And he was asked to just submit one sculpture. He agreed. He decided to show up a month early, to go to Italy a month earlier than was required. He was asked for one sculpture, and in 30 days, he made 27. This is his legend. This guy's work ethic is off the chart. I've talked in the past about Rodin, other sculptors who really had a strong work ethic. David Smith, he worked in his sleep. This man worked every day. Every minute he was thinking about sculpture. He might be doing a drawing. He might be with his children. And he didn't believe in commercial toys. So he would build the toys. He would weld the toys, you know, that kind of thing. There was a project with his daughters. They wanted a horse. And he said to them, if you can make a model, a full-scale model of a horse, I'll buy you one. And he made a welded armature. And then they had to get the plaster and everything, and they had to study the anatomy of a horse and the musculature to make this horse, which they did. They were about 8 or 9. And then he bought them a horse, this kind of thing. So here he is at Voltri. The location was of the Spoleto Festival was Spoleto, but the close town to it, where many of the artists were given studio spaces to work, was called Voltri, V-O-L-T-R-I. And here is David Smith at Voltri in front of some of his sculptures. Now, Smith was given 5 abandoned factories as his studio space, and he was given almost a limitless number of assistants. These studio spaces, or these factories, had not been cleaned out, so they were filled with scraps of metal and wheels and armatures and chains and you name it. So this was like sending this guy to heaven. It's like a kid in a candy store. So this is one of the studios. Here he is down here working on the table. This is one of the studios at Voltri. He produces 27 sculptures. So the committee is totally caught unawares. You know, we asked you for 1, you gave us 27. You know, if we really want to be, good thing this didn't happen in Germany, they would have said, sorry, take the other 26 away. In Italy, that was like, oh my gosh, we didn't expect this. Obviously, we can't show all 27 in the exhibition, so we're going to give you the entire amphitheater, the Roman amphitheater in Voltri, or in Spoleto, to put your sculptures. And that's, of course, what happened. This sculpture here is today in Dallas at the Nasher. This is at the Hirshhorn, and there are various ones, Voltri's here. This is our sculpture. That's the cart, the chariot, Voltri 7, that we have in the atrium right there. Here's another studio working, 62. Here's our sculpture, here and here. On the left is Voltri number 7, which is the one that we own. And then another view inside the factory, one of the factories, and it's hard to read all these, but don't worry about it. But going from left to right, we have Voltri 6, which is at the Nasher in Dallas, Voltri 14, which is in a private collection, Voltri 12 in a private collection, Voltri 7, which is our sculpture in the National Gallery, and Voltri 11. These all date from 1962, from the time at Voltri. So here's ours. Voltri 762. This is made from found materials, iron and various things he found in the various factories that he had access to. This trip to Voltri is life-changing. It absolutely changes his life. He's absolutely inspired now, as you would be, by the Roman landscape, by, of course, Roman and Greek art. He does not burnish these sculptures. They're left in their raw kind of material state. They retain a kind of rusty color, implying a certain age, a considerable age. Smith's connection now to classical art during his time in Italy was totally reinforced. He became obsessed with it. He started to rethink Greek art, Etruscan art, Roman art. These works he referred to, the ones that had wheels, he referred to as chariots. Not all the Voltri sculptures are on wheels. This one is. And here there are separate parts. So let me tell you what was a found object and what he actually made. This he did not make. This is part of in a factory, when you're rolling steel through various kinds of planes and things to cut, you have this little cart that holds the end of the steel up as it's kind of rolling. So this is a found object. This is a found object. This 10-foot bar that has a loop on the end. And then he made these five guys. Now, all of this he welds together. So he welds this to this to this, and then he welds. He cuts, these are forged. He made those. So those are not found. He made all these guys. And then he welds it all together. These five shapes, which look like passengers on the cart, shall we say, or on the chariot, have a particular rhythm, and it's A, B, A, B, A. You see that?
Yes.
So there's a pattern, an A, B, A, B, A pattern. Now, he did literally call the work at Voltree that was on wheels, he did call them chariots. He was thinking of two other things, certainly. First of all, he was thinking of Giacometti on the right. This is our work at the National Gallery by Giacometti, Chariot from 1950, right? That was 12 years earlier. And he certainly knew Giacometti. And Giacometti himself, by the, especially with this tall little traveler, was influenced by Etruscan art as well as Roman art. When David Smith was in Florence, he would have gone and did go to the Archaeological Museum. And this is an Egyptian chariot at the Florence Archaeological Museum. This is the first intact chariot ever discovered. It was discovered in 1829 during an excavation in Thebes. It was in parts, and then they assembled it. So this is actually an Egyptian chariot. When you look at the little guys and their patterns, you recall stridulated sarcophagi. I love that word, stridulated. Some of you may know the term stridule. Anybody know what that is, if you know your Greek sculpture? When Greek athletes would oil them, yeah, when they would oil themselves, they would take this little cupped scraper called a stridule to scrape off the oil, right? But the term in classical art can be used in different ways, and it refers to this kind of pattern on a Roman sarcophagus. So this S-shaped pattern that we have here, we call it a stridulated pattern, or it displays stridulation. This is in the Vatican today, that sarcophagus. It's Roman from the 3rd century. So that seems to be the inspiration for those. And the other idea that relates probably here is that these works, although at the time, certainly Smith didn't know that they were going to, this is kind of an irony, coincidence perhaps, Smith didn't know they were going to end up in the amphitheater, which is where they did end up. And of course, this whole idea here of what potentially could be a Roman cart with a sarcophagus in a funeral procession. Funeral processions, if you were nobility in Rome, would end up at the amphitheater. And that's where there would be a funeral oration to celebrate the dead. So if he's thinking about this as a kind of Roman chariot or cart that has perhaps a sarcophagus on it, it did indeed ultimately end up being at the at the amphitheater. This is a very famous sculpture, but so is this one that's in Dallas. And here it is at Voltree, here in the amphitheater. This is Voltree number 6, and it's here installed at, it's Voltree number 6, yes, correct. There are a couple of other sculptures back here. This, again, is a one with wheels. So it's very much similar to ours in a certain way. This is a found object here. This is a piece that he actually did, that he found that as well. This is not found. And these he cut. These plate steels he cut. And what's interesting about this sculpture, I think, is its relationship. Anybody think of, you have to think kind of outside the box, to a classical sculpture? This idea of almost a winged shape and movement, I think, could relate in some ways to the Nike of Samothrace at the Louvre, which is a 2nd century BC Greek sculpture that I'm sure you all know. So here is the amphitheater. This is all David Smith's work. This is the way the show went on. Here's our sculpture. Now, what you're looking at on the right, for those of you who've been coming to the gallery long enough, and that would mean you've been coming since the 70s, In 1979, just after this building, the East Building opened, we did an exhibition called American Art at Mid-Century, The Subjects of the Artists. It ran from June 1st, 78 to January 14th, 79. And up in the tower, at that time we only had one tower gallery, not what we have today, our designers created the idea of the amphitheater exhibition. So we borrowed all the appropriate sculptures. There's the Dallas sculpture. There's ours. They created that whole stepped amphitheater-like design, and that's how the exhibition, that was the part that related to David Smith. There were other sculptors in that show, but that's how we sort of foregrounded David Smith's work. It was an incredible installation. These guys can do anything. Speaking of which, we come to the circles. Now, here are the three circles we own at the National Gallery. Circle 1, 2, and 3, and they're all from 1962. And they're today somewhere up in the mezzanine. I know we keep moving these things. Circle 4 is this one, which is very strange because it's cut. It looks like circles bleeding into each other. And one that you don't see that often is this one. That's the last one, Circle 5 from 63. And that is, the reason you don't see it is it's because it's in the J.P. Morgan Chase collection in New York, a private collection owned by the corporation. Now, this is where we have to confront David Smith as a painter, because now these have color that he was very serious about. Remember, he had studied with Matulka and others. The circle series is the one where he was addressing, there are five circles, although there are many other works that relate to this, but technically there are five in the series. These kind of speak to, again, his interest in painting, in blurring the distinction between painting and sculpture, three dimension and flatness. These are strange. You may think this is sort of, these are just normal colors. They're industrial colors. They're unique. They're tonalities you don't find in traditional art. And again, he was looking for this idea of kind of raw color. So here are our three sculptures. Of course, they have no inner core. They're open, so they're ring-like shapes with these geometric strips that one sees. The fact that the core of the sculpture is empty is interesting because there were a lot of artists, especially in England, the two that we think of are Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, who were constantly investigating the inner part of a sculpture, the core. But they had a core. It went into something. These don't have a core. They just open up to the space, so they're different. And in that regard, they kind of inform us to think about certain symbolic connotations. For example, targets, signals, wheels, frames, passages, tunnels, viewfinders. All of those things could relate to looking through this kind of circular form. They deal with these ideas of space and color, field of vision. What is sad, I don't mean this as a criticism, because what else are we, well, I guess we do have options. But what's sad with these sculptures is that they totally deaden inside. So when we look at these sculptures against the wall, they die in a certain way. There's a deadness to them. This is how Smith wanted it to be seen. So this is our sculpture at Bolton Landing, a photograph by David Smith for circle number one. And this is the way we see it, depending on how we move these things around a lot and come up with different configurations. But this is the way you see it. And there was an interview with David Smith in 64 and talking about circles and things. And he said, "Don't forget, when one chooses a couple of old iron rings from a hub of a wagon, they are circles, they are suns." So he thought along those particular way. Now, one of the things we do sometimes to kind of speak to this is we put them against the window. And even this is better to see out through towards Pennsylvania Avenue and the foliage and all that. So that's, you know, that's a good effort. That's a yeoman effort. But how did Smith put them in the field at Bolton Landing? What was his preferred installation? Here is Bolton Landing. This is the program, the plan, the chart that shows every sculpture and where he placed it. Here is his house. Here's one. This is the sculpture studio. This is the painting and drawing studio. Here's everything. So where are the circles? The circles are right here.
This is circle 3, circle 2, circle 1, circle 5. Where's circle 4? It's not in this axis. It's over here. It's relegated to the distant field. That's the one that's cut. You know what I was just saying, showing you that one? What he wanted you to do, really, is this. This is his own photograph at Bolton Landing. He wanted you to look through the four circles that he would place in an axis here. So the axis he wanted, if we were counting, depending on which direction you're going, is 3, 2, 1, 5. That's the way it works, 3, 2, 1, 5. The other one, number 4, is on the distant placement. Now, in 2014, at the Clark Institute in Massachusetts, in Williamstown, they did a circle show. It was called Raw Color. And they brought all five circles together. And then what they did was to install them in the exhibition the way you would have seen them in the field, like this. So this is the Clark Institute exhibition called Raw Color, The Circles of David Smith, from 2014. This is the, now you could look this way or that way, it doesn't matter. But they create this alignment, which is very important. I mean, he wanted you moving, I think, this way. So here, and then here's a close-up of putting them together. Now that looks like a painting. It looks like an abstract expressionist painting almost. So Smith described his color used here as a color that did not have what he called, quote, previous acceptance. So they were colors that weren't usually part of the palette of most artists. And then he referred to them as, again, as raw. It was raw color and ready-made, but it was non-primary. It was not the kind of traditional colors based on the primary sources. And at one point, Smith very famously remarked, to sort of reinforce this, he said, quote, "I belong with the painters." So he thought of himself as very much in that regard. Of course, that caused nothing but incredible anxiety and consternation for Clement Greenberg. And Clement Greenberg is, in some ways, both the friend, he was one of the executors of Smith's estate, and a villain, because as soon as a sculptor says, "I belong with the painters," and creates things like this, it violates the most important basic premise of Clement Greenberg, that each art has to be decided and formed by what it is that is unique to that art. And painting for Greenberg had to be flat and have color, not sculpture. So if you're telling me sculpture should be flat and have color, I got a problem. And Greenberg, I can't get into all this, but in one of the most controversial acts of Clement Greenberg, there were a number of David Smith sculptures that he had painted white that you can see today at Storm King and some other places. After Smith's death, Greenberg was one of the executors, and he was convinced that those sculptures were not meant by Smith to be white, and that what they were, in fact, was that was a primary coat, you know. And even given that, if he had intended to paint them, what Greenberg said is that should be stripped off. That should be stripped off. And he stripped it off. There was a huge controversy. Every scholar on David Smith weighed in one way or another. Rosalind Krauss, who had written her dissertation on David Smith, etc. Today, we've dismissed because David Smith did begin to intend to have sculpture that was painted. There's no question about it. And this was not a problem for him. So that's just, you can read about that because, believe me, it's everywhere in the literature. This work was probably the most ambitious investigation of sculpture and color that Smith executed, the Circle series, probably. Now, the other person that's interesting, I mean, all this kind of goes together. At this time, one of his closest friends is the Washington Color School artist, Kenneth Nolan. This is Kenneth Nolan's painting on the left called Number One from 1958. This is a painting owned by Clement Greenberg. And on the right, this sculpture at Bolton Landing is titled Nolan's Blues from 1961 by David Smith. It's a tribute to his friend Kenneth Nolan, who liked jazz and the blues. Certainly, there's the other side of this. How much was Smith getting from Kenneth Nolan about color now, especially within the form of a circle? And he was probably getting a hell of a lot. He liked Kenneth Nolan. They had met in 51. Smith was 18 years older than Kenneth Nolan, but they had a very close relationship. Smith was there on the night Nolan was there on the night that Smith died in the hospital after the car crash. In fact, he was coming from Kenneth Nolan's house near Bennington, Vermont. The other thing that's interesting here is that Smith began, even though he was older than Nolan, at this point in his career, he started to hang around a bunch of artists who were all in and around Bennington, Vermont. That's why he started to spend more and more time up there. And when he would go to Bennington, he would stay with Kenneth Nolan. But it included Kenneth Nolan, Jules Zelitsky, Helen Frankenthaler, and Anthony Carroll, the British sculptor. They were part of a little group around Bennington. They taught at Bennington, etc. And Smith infiltrated that. He didn't infiltrate it. They certainly invited him. But he was older than all those people. Carroll says, and I've seen hundreds of interviews with Anthony Carroll, he says his two father figures as a sculptor were Henry Moore and David Smith, but for very different reasons, for very, very different reasons. In any case, this is clearly another connection, Smith to Nolan, to the experiments of the DC Color School. Here is Kenneth Nolan in David Smith's studio. This is from the American Archives, probably dates to the 60s. So that's Nolan standing in David Smith's studio. This is Nolan's Blues that is currently under conservation. And so this is a conservator who's working on the sculpture. Smith is in Voltry. That's a period of months, a couple of months. Then he's got to come home. And of course, he's looking around at all this metal, right? And wow, I would love to take all that with me. So he ships about 80 tons of metal back to Bolton Landing. He just says, okay, everything here, we're taking it back. Crate it up and ship it. That all comes back to Bolton Landing. From that cache of metal now, and it's everything, it's wheels, it's armatures, it's metal, it's you name it. He enters the next series that we call appropriately the Voltry Bolton series. It's done at Bolton Landing, but it's using materials, most of which came from Voltry. That series is sometimes called the Voltron series. Sometimes that's the term. Sometimes it's referred to as the VB series. But probably the more reasonable term is Voltry Bolton. This is Voltry Bolton number 10 on the left, photographed at Bolton Landing in 62. These are sculptures here. These are all Voltry Bolton sculptures. And he just had them all. He stood them all up against his wall of his studio here and took this photograph from 1962. There are 25 works in the Voltry Bolton series, so it's a pretty substantial series. He's still working off of this Italian high. I mean, he's so excited and enthusiastic still from that trip. Most of the Voltry Boltons are like the Tang totems in that they're vertical. Many of them have a kind of connection to the human figure in that sense. He does use a lot of cut pipe concave shapes, like the Tang totem series as well. They're figurative, but having said that, the way he's beginning to use these shapes now is not in a metaphorical way. So he's not so much concerned that this looks like a head or this looks like a face. He's just using them more, he's choosing things more based on just formal relationships. Here's the field at Bolton Landing in the winter. Here are circles. So the photograph on the left is 62, 63, and the one on the right is 63. This photograph is taken by David Smith on the right. This one is taken by a photographer who became a very close friend and gives us most of the photographs. His name was Dan Budnick, B-U-D-N-I-K. I'm not going to go through and identify all these, but there's our circles, and there is that sculpture that you see there, and I am going to show you that, which is here. This one is actually, it is called Voltron 18. And before I'm asked,
This is, and I'll give you the entire location because it's not that well known. It is in the Corning Tower Plaza lobby of the Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller Empire State Plaza Art Collection in the Empire State Plaza in Albany, New York. And they have about five other sculptures by David Smith in that collection. So here it is in Albany, here. But one of my favorite photographs is the one in the center, where he's sort of, this is at Bolton Landing in 1963. I do admit I have probably an overly romantic idea of David Smith. And that photograph in the center, where this guy is out in the snow in the winter by himself wrestling a sculpture, is the image I have of David Smith. I know it's droll and not very popular these days to say these things, but he is a heroic figure to me in that particular regard. He only had one assistant who was there on any regular basis, a guy named Leon Pratt. And other than that, he's out there wrestling these things. This is Voltry Bolton number 10. I just showed you number 18. This is the sketch on the left by David Smith. It's dated December 22, 1962. That's the sculpture in the middle from 1962. And then this was recently, the sculpture is photographed here in England, where it was in an exhibition. And that is just before it was put up for auction. So a guy who almost no sculptures in his lifetime. What are you going to do with some gigantic 8-foot thing? You're going to stick it in your living room? So he had to teach through his entire career. He got a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1950. He had artisan residencies. He taught at Indiana University, University of Arkansas, and also at Sarah Lawrence. He always had this conflict between, I have to earn a living, but I want to do my art, that kind of thing. So this sculpture, Voltry Bolton 10, was put up for auction at Sotheby's in November of 2017, and it sold for $8,695,500. It had been in a private collection in New York, the Stern Collection. There's a couple that were very great collectors in New York City. They decided to finally sell it. This is all, again, welded. These are tongs. So it's very much like what we were talking about. It's various tools and things that he just welds together. But these photographs are important. This is a series of photographs that were taken by Dan Budnick of Smith at work on Voltry Bolton 10. And this is important because you see he starts all the sculptures on the floor, like relief sculptures. And once he gets some kind of a format, and while he's doing that, what he does is he tack welds them. So he has the welding torch and he can just tack these things so that they stay where he wants them. If he doesn't want it, then he can kick it apart and still reconfigure it. But he developed a technique of working, which is particularly spontaneous and process-oriented, and it's what he called toeing. And that is to say, when he would try to arrange these things on the floor, he wouldn't use his hands. He would just kick them. He would kick them with his toes, which means you're not going to get necessarily the perfect, you know. And then if he saw some, oh, I like that, he'd tack it. If not, he'd kick it again. And these things would just kind of, it was like a free-flowing kind of a puzzle. And we actually have that photograph here of Smith doing that, which is interesting because he used to wear sandals that were open-toed. And he's kicking like 2-inch steel, that kind of stuff. So we have the effects of chance, of the accident, of a spontaneous kind of process. So these are a couple of the Voltry Bolton series. Then we come to the wagons. There are only three sculptures in the wagon series. And this basically is between 63 and 64. This is wagon number one. That is today at the National Gallery of Art in Canada, Ottawa, from 1963-64. In the wagons now, you have to be careful here, we do not have a sculpture that is on wheels, like the Zig series. These are sculptures in and of themselves that incorporate wheels as part of their very existence as wagons. So this obsession with the chariot, going back to Voltry, and now he's creating these gigantic wagons. His ambition, unrealized in his life,
was to create a gigantic railroad train where he would make every cart and that it would actually work, like it could tootle around Bolton Landing. That was, of course, never realized. Here again, there's a lot of interest. This is a huge, thick piece of steel that looks almost flexible now. It almost looks like it could throw this guy up into the air, you know, like it's a piece of rope. This form itself is interesting. It looks almost like a mechanistic, robotic kind of form. So this is wagon number one. This is wagon number two from 1964. That's today at the Tate in London. This is the heavy, ponderous, thick, this wagon compared to wagon number one. The weights involved here are incredible. These three wheels, the small wheels, each weigh 275 pounds. There are some 3,800 pounds of forged steel in this sculpture. It's just incredible, and you sense that. This is different. It's not the fleet, it's not the kind of lifted sculpture of the previous wagon. He was very much adamant about that. He threw the pieces that he had, and what he did was he threw all these metal pieces outside for almost a year to allow them to rust and discolor before he then finally began to sort of assemble this. So it is related back to the chariot, to the Voltry series that I just mentioned. Occasionally what he would do, Smith was devoted to his children. They were the love of his life, these two girls. And they were there watching. He did numerous sculptures that were named for his children, etc. But often he would sneak in a little reference because he said to his children, you know, I'm older than your normal father should be to have children your age. When I die, you're probably still going to be young. And so he, on this wheel, he put the little phrase, "Hi, Candida." So a number of his sculptures are ways that he wanted to stay in touch with his children after his death, because they would go and find their name or some kind of a salutation or something. So here are the two in juxtaposition, number one and number two, but there are three in the series. And the third one couldn't be more different than both of these, and that's today in Kansas City at the Nelson Atkins. This is wagon number three from 64. This is like now, clearly almost, I call it a celestial chariot. Smith was very intrigued by the sky, by the stars, by constellations. At Bolton Landing at night in upstate New York, you just saw this incredible array of stars. And so he was very interested in all of that. And this, I think, speaks to that. It certainly relates to Giacometti. It has the more spindly kind of ideas that we were just talking about. It has certain shapes. It has a crescent moon, a full circle, which is kind of like a sun shape, a six-pointed star, and a diamond. So that's what you have going across here on this thin, sort of these thin legs. This is a piece of thick, thick iron bar that he twists like a Tootsie Roll. And he twists it in these three places. Here, that even that is amazing in and of itself. What I have not shown you, the series I have not shown you, you can look it up yourself, is called The Forgings. And this is when he would just take rod and bar and hammer it out on an anvil and twist it and do certain things. I didn't show you that series. It's interesting always because in many museums, when they have Smith in the same room as the Abstract Expressionist, they often juxtapose Smith to Franz Klein. And to prove that point, here's the National Gallery. In the initial installation, it's changed now, but when we reopened this building initially, we had the Smith sculpture right against the Klein. And it is a magnificent juxtaposition. Smith and Klein are similar in certain ways. Klein was born in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He grew up fascinated by railroads, locomotives, bridges, industrial plants, structures, and there is that kind of resemblance between the two of them. Here is just a couple of shots of his installation of his figures at Bolton Landing. These are both from 64.
And then we come here to 1958, and now this is moving us towards arguably his greatest series, the one that had the greatest impact on later artists. He started in the late 50s to work in stainless steel, and he would burnish it. And the idea was that, of course, it was meant to be more or less outside again. This is a work on the left, two slides is the same work here, called 15 Planes from 1958. This is still at the Smith Estate. And on the right is 25 Planes from 1958. That's at the National Gallery of Art in Australia, in Canberra. He begins to now have sheets of stainless steel and pieces of stainless steel fabricated, sent to him, and then he welds them together. And then he burnishes them with an industrial grinder, right? You know, the thing you use to fix your fender, that kind of thing. The initial ones are these, in which he just names the work after the number of planes that are in it, so 1525. There was a moment when he thought, well, here's what he said. He said, I'm still working on the stainless steel pieces, meaning these. These I call unities. His first thought was, I'm going to call these unities. And they are further identified by the number of planes they have. I have no tangible word relationships with subject matter where these are concerned. They're completely visual. So he's not trying to create a bug or a person or something. These are clearly tune-ups, in my estimation, 57, 58. These are the tune-ups for the greatest series he produces, one of the greatest series of sculptures in the 20th century, and that's the Cubi series. So here are three of them when they were still at Bolton Landing. Cubi number 18 on the left from 64, number 17 from 63, and number 19 from 64. Today, going left to right, far left, it's in the MFA at Boston. The one in the center is in the Dallas Museum of Fine Arts, and the one on the right is at the Tate in London. Now, this is a series he intended to be seen out of doors, display out of doors. He chose stainless steel for the purpose, and he burnished it to achieve a maximum amount of reflectivity. He had tuned up for this with those sculptures I just showed you, but now he gets into a realm. There are 28 sculptures in this series, the most in any series that he produces. It is a heroic body of work. And here he's definitely dealing now with all kinds of ideas about the basic language of sculpture, form, weight, mass, structure, positive, negative, balance, imbalance, center of gravity, no center of gravity, all of that. But also, of course, these industrial materials that he's using in a way unlike any that were ever used. He talks about this series because he's asked about this all the time. And at one point in an interview, he said, I like outdoor sculpture, and the most practical thing for outdoor sculpture is stainless steel. And I made them and I polished them in such a way that on a dull day, they take on the dull blue or the color of the sky in the late afternoon sun. Some are down by the water and some are by the mountain. They reflect the colors. They are designed for outdoors. And then he says in another interview, they are conceived for bright light, preferably the sun, to develop the illusion of surface and depth. Stainless steel seems dead without light. And with too much light, it becomes car chrome. So he's working in this little area. Now here is the one in Boston today, no longer at Bolton Landing, Cubi 18 from 1964. When you look at these things, it's amazing. When you try to think about, well, how the hell is all that together and what's the center of gravity and is it gonna topple over and all of that? But in this particular one, it's the burnishing. Again, this is a technique. Believe me, you could use a burnisher, and if you don't know how to do it, and you start it rolls you right off of the metal, and you fall on your head. And this is why sometimes he's talked about as an abstract expressionist in terms of the brush stroke of the burnisher, that kind of thing. And the other point is, despite even these photographs here, these sculptures die inside. I don't care how you light them or where you put them, try to put them near a window or whatever. Now, there are three subcategories of Cubi, and I've illustrated them here. There's the category that rests on a kind of a T,
a kind of a T support, one stem with a long lintel like this. And this is the one from the Tate, 1964, number 19. There are cubis that are low to the ground and that, in fact, tend to resemble a human figure, like a reclining figure here, legs, torso. This is from LACMA, LA County Museum. This is number 23 from 1964. And then there are the frame or open window ones, like this one. And that's at the this one's at the Guggenheim. So he has these three sort of, I call them subcategories, subgroups, and each one challenges him in a different way. This is the one in Chicago in the Art Institute, cubi number 7 from 1963, and that's two shots of it from just slightly different angles. So you can see how it changes when you start to move around it. And then this is a spray drawing that clearly was the study for this sculpture. So there he is on the right making a spray drawing that will ultimately be the tune-up for the sculpture that he's creating. They often do present a frontal plane and you think, okay, I got it. But then as soon as you take a step and rotate around, the whole thing just shifts. All the blocks get thrown up again. This is the one that we now have. This is when it was in the sculpture garden, but now it is on the roof of the East Building on the terrace. So this is the one on loan to us from the Kayfritz Foundation. This is cubi 11 from 1963. These are not found object pieces, remember? So he's ordering from a company stainless steel parts that he's then going to put together. And you can see again how it changes these precarious kinds of relationships. These again would be the sort of the T bar. Technically, you don't have a T here, but nonetheless, it's the same idea. And then in terms of the reclining types, this is the one that we have in our sculpture garden. This is cubi number 26. I mean, you can look at that. It looks like a figure leaping up from having been seated and maybe trying to get up. It has a certain sort of animation to it. And then the third category, which are the frame ones that open up to they're kind of a frame. This is cubi number 27 in the Guggenheim on the left, but the way you should see it, at Bolton Landing on the right. And you see the difference? It just dies on the left. It just really deadens it. These are the sculptures that obsessed younger artists, the minimalists, Donald Judd, a whole host of people. These were the works by Smith that had the greatest impact on the subsequent development of sculpture due to their geometry, et cetera. So who do these sculptures affect? Right here at the National Gallery, they affected Anthony Caro, who did this welded piece for the opening of the East Building. They affected Joel Shapiro on the right, who did this sculpture that we own in our sculpture garden, Untitled, from 1989. Clearly here, especially, it was the materials, the formal language. It affected Mark DeSouvereau that we have at the sculpture garden on the left, Aurora, from 1992. It even affected somebody like Roxy Payne. Why? Because that tree is stainless steel. That's a material now that sculptors thought they could use. His investigations of color affected John Chamberlain on the left. This is Dolores James from 1962. Affected Anne Truitt, a wall for apricots in the middle from 68. Affected Donald Judd on the lower right from 1963, Untitled. Affected DeSouvereau, the work at the Hirshhorn on the left. And even Anthony Caro on the right. That's a Caro painted sculpture. Caro had a real kind of, what shall we say, anxiety about painted or unpainted sculptures. And the thing that complicated his anxiety about painted sculpture is that all of those painted sculptures always sold, and the other ones did not. This is Smith, again, at Voltri. On the right is that photograph I brought back that shows Helen Frankenthaler and David Smith and Motherwell. And the reason I would end here is because after the death of David Smith, Robert Motherwell, he had three executors of his estate. It was a lawyer, one of his lawyers. It was Clement Greenberg. And unbeknownst to Motherwell, he was named one of the executors.
and that was a surprise to Motherwell. In any case, Motherwell writes one of the most beautiful reflections on an artist and sort of tributes that I've ever read. If you want to find this for yourselves, I can point you to the source where it comes from. It is a Robert Motherwell. It's called Reflections on David Smith. It is reproduced in a book that's an interesting book that came out in 1967. It's a book called The Party's Over by John Gruen. The Party's Over by John Gruen, G-R-U-E-N. And in that book, talking about the abstract generation, abstract expression generation, he cites this reflection. Robert Motherwell is a very special artist. First of all, he's incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-read, and really a great, great writer. So having him write this, very few people could write something like this as beautifully as Robert Motherwell could. So in that sense, it is really quite a tribute. Thank you very much, everybody.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.